We want the city, we want the system, and we want the state to take seriously this problem.
Elgin Rapid Response Team reports one man was detained, though it's not clear if more were involved.
It discourages me, it disgusts me, the actions of the federal agents that came to our city.
This is about making sure that what happened to Crystal never happens to another family.
Hi, Chicago. I'm Claire Lane, in for Sasha and Simons. This is In the Loop. It's Friday, so it's time for our weekly news recap. We saw some ICE action in Elgin this week. The family of CPD officer Crystal Rivera, who was shot and killed by her partner, has filed a wrongful death suit. Plus, the budget showdown continues in City Hall.
Johnson's new proposal is to tax companies with more than 500 employees.
He talks about working people, but you can't have working people without jobs.
With these deadlines quickly approaching, we simply cannot risk a shutdown and put the city's financial stability at risk.
The mayor has vowed to veto any proposal that does not tax the wealthy.
No one wants it, you know, but it's something that I'm working overtime to ensure that it doesn't happen.
Recapping those stories and more in just a minute. But first, one of our panelists, Tom Shuba with the Chicago Sun-Times, is in studio with me. Tom, we had a lot to get to today. No shortage of news, and we had to skip over a story. Teen curfews, apparently they're back in the mix. What do we need to know?
So Alderman Brian Hopkins, who had previously introduced what they call the snap curfew, has come back this week and introduced a new proposal. This comes in the wake of two shootings that happened following the Christmas tree lighting downtown. One teenager was killed. A host of other kids were shot. So this new proposal essentially would require the city to declare a curfew 12 hours before it's going to be implemented. The curfew can only last 4 hours. And this is, you know, in the wake of this kind of stubborn problem around what they call teen trends. These are events that crop up on social media and are advertised there, and they draw crowds of kids, typically downtown, sometimes to the beaches, other parts of the city. Hopkins previously proposed that snap curfew. That would allow a curfew to be implemented within 30 minutes of when it's declared. The mayor, Brandon Johnson, did not like that proposal at all. He vetoed it. And he was concerned that it could lead to lawsuits. It could lead to the erosion of trust between the community and the police department. And so he stiff-armed it, essentially. And so Hopkins went back to the drawing board, and he came up with a proposal that he says he thinks addresses all of the mayor's issues. And we'll see.
Tom, thanks so much. The rest of our panel, Monica Ng, Chicago reporter with Axios, and David Greising, president of the Better Government Association. Back to City Council, David started us off with the money woes and the clash between Alders and Mayor Johnson. Here's David.
Well, this is an epic standoff that's been going on for weeks, and this coming week will really probably hit its peak. The council is expected to meet at least 4 days next week. There's been wrangling, of course. It's really, in some ways, a binary decision. Is there going to be a head tax, or is there not going to be a head tax? There's all kinds of noise around a lot of different things, about the grocery tax, garbage collection fees, et cetera, whether to borrow to cover a pension or a payment to firefighters, et cetera. But really, the big political fight is the head tax or no head tax. Mayor Johnson is determined to push through a head tax. He's tried three different versions. His latest is now on companies of 500 employees or more, which there's a very small number, and the amount of money he expects to get from that is way below that $100 million he was shooting for when he originally introduced the head tax idea. His opponents in city council, who now have enough votes to force a vote on the budget, they don't think they have enough votes for an override if the mayor were to veto that budget. But if there is a budget passed that's not the mayor's budget and the mayor vetoes it, then it's going to be a really dramatic political situation.
And he did make that concession, as you're mentioning this week, on his preferred corporate headex. Monica, what exactly did he propose? What was the big change that he made? And do you think it really helped to make any progress with Alders?
Well, he went from companies of over 100 employees to 200, then back to 100. And now it's companies like, he said, Walmart or Mondelez or T-Mobile or Citibank that would be affected. And it would be $33 per person per month. That was rejected soundly. And then the Alders, you know, the 26 Alders who originally came up with an alternate plan, tweaked that, 27 of them now, you know, are introducing this, like, the new garbage fee. And, you know, it would be about $6 more than the previous garbage fee. And the mayor said he would not accept any budget like that. And really, are we fighting over a $6 increase in garbage fees per month? Is that the hill people want to die on? It's a lot of heel digging at this point, and we don't have a lot of time left.
And David, are there any other key points in what that group of Alders and that rival plan, in addition to the garbage fee that they're proposing?
Russ, the group of Alders, the 27 now, they've added about $409 million of various amendments to the mayor's budget. They have adopted many of the ideas of this consulting report from the firm EY, formerly Ernst & Young, that the mayor basically rejects. He says they're unworkable, et cetera. And yet they've gone through with a fine-tooth comb, and they think they've found a lot of money there that the mayor's unwilling to consider. And back to Monica's point, on the garbage collection fee, yes, it's a dollar on a dollar basis, but politically what you can say is it nearly doubles what people in the neighborhoods are paying to have their garbage collected. And it also fits into the progressive argument that the mayor is making. Tax the ultra-rich and be sympathetic to the people in the neighborhoods for whom, you know, a $5 increase in garbage collection is meaningful. And the politics of this are really, it's him establishing him, his reestablishing or underlining his progressive credentials with an eye toward when he runs for reelection that he locks in the role as the progressive mayor.
And the last time, Monica, that Alders passed their own alternate budget was back when we still called them aldermen. Right.
That's right. Not Alders. In 1983 for the 1984 budget. And then that was the council wars. That was Eddie Burke and Eddie Verdoliak against Mayor Harold Washington. And it would be wrong to say that this is council wars all over again. This is not racial like that. Half the Black caucus is on this, you know, 27 Alders side. You have a very mixed group that is proposing this alternate budget. It's sort of like the Democratic Socialists versus moderates to conservatives versus reform versus machine, which it was under Harold Washington.
And you've seen people move back and forth.
Right, too. Progressives.
Alderperson Pat Dowell is now with the anti-Johnson coalition. She was one of his big stalwarts and really Johnson's big stalwarts, and she really understands budget and finance. She's a real expert, and her move over to the other side is significant.
So it's very complex. You know, anybody who wants to paint it as black and white, which both sides do, well, you know, Mayor Brandon Johnson is like, oh, this is all about corporations versus people, but it's more mixed than that.
Many shades of gray in the Alders. And part of this opposing plan, Tom, relies on revenue from a proposed slot machines potentially at O'Hare and Midway. If anyone wants to weigh in on this, would anyone be up for gambling before a flight? Potentially, would that make an airport experience more hectic, more enjoyable, hitting the slots?
I mean, Jason Lee, who's the mayor's top advisor, has said it would look a little seedy to add casino-style gambling to our airports, and not really Chicago's brand, but it's part of the proposal.
I think gambling is becoming so commonplace that people are just kind of, it's not as the stigma that I think it once was, but this is one of those instances where I kind of agree with Jason Lee. It's not a great look, but I think it's probably inevitable.
Well, the budget, this, you know, proposal is counting on $50 million in revenue from these proposed airport slot machines. I mean, is that a realistic number?
It may not be a realistic number, and it may not be realistic given our contract with Bally's. Bally's feels like this might take away from their slot machines, which we actually get a decent amount of revenue from. So, you know, it's in the proposal. Would it actually fly in practice? Hard to say.
Tom?
I would not bet on slot machines.
No. So to speak.
I have no other insights here. Sounds a little bit like Reno, Nevada to me. But
and more screens. So let's hear a bit more about what the mayor had to say about the aldermanic budget.
I don't support a budget that places such an incredible burden on working people at a time in which President Trump has made life quite difficult for working people across this country. The city of Chicago should not be adding to that burden. And so, no, I cannot support a budget that nearly doubles the garbage fee for working people.
And we sort of touched on this a bit, David, but, you know, he seems really to be arguing this budget is going against his principles and what he stands for.
Yes, and he is carving that out. And the thing is, we should poke back on that a little bit. For example, that $100 million head tax or whatever it ends up being, you know, he said that all of that money would be additive. It would add to fighting for community violence intervention, et cetera. Claims there's a bunch of new money going to that when, in fact, if you drill down in the numbers, as I did in a column for the Tribune last week, that doesn't really hold up. It basically, the spending is equal from what it was last year. So he put sort of a new brand on how he plans to pay for some of these things, but he's not actually using the money to substantially increase spending. So it really is just a new tax to really help cover expenses, but it doesn't really advance his progressive agenda the way he claims it does.
Well, and at the end of the road, you know, come December 31st, if there is no budget, that would mean a government shutdown. Is that really possible?
Yeah, that is really uncharted territory, and it was a question that hadn't really been asked, although Bill Conway, the alderperson, has said they'll have they'll pass a law to keep an ordinance to keep things going, more or less, essential services type stuff. But this has not been done. And unlike in the federal context, where there you can pass a continuing resolution and kind of delay the actual shutdown, in this case, it'd be a pretty firm shutdown as of the end of December 31st.
Monica, would that mean government offices would be closed, back to garbage? Is that not going to be picked up if this theoretically were to happen?
Well, since we haven't seen it, we're not sure. But theoretically, yes, city workers wouldn't be paid. And, you know, it could really bring a lot of things to a standstill.
Tom, impact on public safety? Cops? Not getting paychecks.
Cops will continue to patrol the
city.
They will.
But
okay. They won't be paid. The cops are paid from the same budget, unlike CPS or the Park District.
So that wouldn't really be a big impact?
I'd assume that they will continue to staff the police districts and ensure that...
They've said as much. The question will be when those paychecks come, because there is not budget available. If the government is shut down, there's not budget available to pay people in real time. So you might have cops who have to call their bank and say, I can't make my mortgage payment this month because I haven't been paid. I'll get you next month, that sort of thing.
And we talked about this a bit this week earlier on BEZ that, you know, the budget stalemate is already having an impact potentially on the city's bond rating, right? Explain, David, what this could mean for all of us.
Well, we're on notice from Standard & Poor's, one of the leading rating agencies, that Chicago has a negative outlook, which means that if anything goes wrong, our credit rating could go down one more notch. We're just one notch right now about what they call junk status, i.e. our bond rating is as low nearly as it can get. Once it goes into junk status, it's really damaging to the city's economy. It becomes very difficult to borrow, very expensive to borrow, et cetera. It really affects city government and the cost of city government, and affects us ultimately because we pay for that. The rating agencies are very scared of the uncertainty that they're seeing, and they're always also very concerned about some of the ideas that Mayor Johnson is floating in order to try to balance his budget. The idea of borrowing. Chicago is heavily indebted. I think it's the most indebted city in the country. And to then add to that, just to kind of pay bills, not to make infrastructure investments, et cetera, which is what borrowing really is for, but just to pay the bills, is reckless to begin with. And the credit agencies are keeping a very close eye on what's going on here.
And, you know, with this potential, you know, city bond rating, as well as the threat of a government shutdown, anybody feel like this might shadow, you know, Mayor Brandon Johnson's legacy or overshadow his popularity right now as sort of being questioned? I mean, is this just going to continue to sort of leave a black mark?
Well, it's not going to be good. And, you know, a lot of people really thought the mayor would raise property taxes his first year just so he could get that out of the way. And so it's all coming back to haunt him that we have this $1.2 billion deficit that nobody, when they walk out of the room and they finally clear this up, hopefully before December 31st, everyone should feel like they've had a bite taken out of them, because everyone's going to need to sacrifice something. At this point, people are digging in their heels. these proposals to borrow more, to use one-time revenue sources to pay for things, they're not going to be good for our bond rating. And a lot of Andre Vasquez is one of the people who's calling that out, saying we cannot let our city go into junk status. It's going to haunt our children and our grandchildren. And when we try to borrow to fix our aging infrastructure, we're going to be paying high, high rates.
We've got some more issues involving law enforcement. The family of Crystal Rivera, a Chicago police officer shot by her partner during a chase, has filed a wrongful death suit. Tom, remind us what happened back in June.
Sure. So officers Crystal Rivera and Carlos Baker were working in the Gresham District on the south side. They saw a gunman run into an apartment complex. They gave chase. They went into the apartment complex. Officer Baker opened a door. Another gunman was aiming a rifle at them. Somehow, Officer Baker's gun fired, struck and killed Crystal Rivera. And, you know, it's one of these instances where we have an officer shot and killed. Kind of the police department really rallies around the families. In this case, this was kind of a strange incident. We have the police department saying that this was a kind of a friendly fire incident, a tragic accident. But we have Rivera's family coming out, and they have in the past too, questioning the official narrative and now filing this lawsuit that, you know, has some pretty bombshell claims, including that the two officers had been dating, that Crystal Rivera had broken up with Carlos Baker, that he was, and that she had threatened to tell another girlfriend that they had been dating, that he had come to her house the day before uninvited. And so it's, you know, really, really troubling claims in this lawsuit, including essentially that after Baker shot Crystal Rivera, that he left her to die. He didn't call for an ambulance. He didn't render aid. And that he misidentified to dispatchers who the shooter was, that he said shots were fired at the police, not that I fired my weapon.
And I remember working that morning early and the press conference, you know, held at something like 4:45 in the morning. Mayor Brandon Johnson was there. You know, CPD was all over calling it friendly fire, just a tragedy. That's a very big step from what happened this week in the lawsuit.
It's a huge step. And so Carlos Baker has had some real serious disciplinary problems. And what Crystal Rivera's family says is essentially that he shouldn't have been a police officer. He had gotten in all this trouble. In one case, he allegedly flashed a gun at a woman that he tracked down to a restaurant who wouldn't date him. That case was ultimately dropped because the purported victim wouldn't cooperate with police, or with COPO rather. And so you have these instances of what they say are troubling cases involving women. And even after the shooting, Carlos Baker was allegedly involved in a bar fight in Wicker Park. And he's been stripped of his police powers since then because allegedly he called to a neighboring business posing as an investigator and trying to get the video footage. So there's certainly a lot of smoke here. But what John Catanzara, the head of the FOP, says is that this lawsuit is completely off base. He took a shot at Tony Romanucci, who's a very powerful civil rights attorney who's representing Rivera's family. And he said that he belongs below the Mariana Trench and that he's stooped to this terrible level. And he said the body cam footage will disprove a lot of the claims in this lawsuit. So really, we're now kind of in a holding pattern to see how all this is going to play out, including the COPA investigation and all this.
Well, that's what I was just going to ask. Has CPD responded other than, you know, just continuing to sort of call this a tragedy? And has COPA responded to the lawsuit?
No. So CPD specifically, you know, won't comment because it's pending litigation. So the other issue here is the two gunmen, alleged gunmen, who had been arrested after this incident, their cases are pending. And so in one of those cases, there's a hold on releasing the body cam footage. So we haven't seen exactly what happened, what John Catanzara says disproves the claims of Rivera's family.
The reason we know a lot of this stuff is because of some great reporting that Tom has, along with colleagues of mine, of Casey Toner and Peter Nikas, has dug into this story really since the shooting happened. And in a day when journalism is sort of under threat and we don't have the resources to do this kind of like really deep dive reporting, I feel grateful to know as much as we do about this case and the fact that this woman, I mean, this just gets, it just has this smell about it, right from the start that something wasn't quite right. And you guys have just followed your instincts and really proved there's not.
And why our ears kind of perked up when this happened and the night that it happened and we, you know, work police sources and you hear the officers involved and that Crystal Rivera was killed. We had been doing reporting about a gun that went missing at the Gresham District Station. And Crystal Rivera was the key witness in that case. Her names were actually on the inventory sheets for that Glock that was stolen and then used in a series of shootings. And, you know, we got interviews with her in which she said, I searched everywhere. I tried to find this gun. I searched in my colleagues' backpacks. I couldn't find it. She cooperated with the police. She hasn't been accused of wrongdoing. But it's among a series of incidents in the 6th District, the Gresham District, that raise a lot of questions about the district itself and the tactical team that Rivera and Baker were on.
Well, I know you did a lot of digging, too, into the past of Carlos Baker and his history. You brought up, you know, several instances in the past, alleged instances of situations with women, violent situations potentially with women. I mean, how is that sort of playing into, I guess, the history, at least in your reporting, of domestic violence, you know, in this case and the department itself?
Yeah, so that, like I said, there's these two key incidents with women before and after the shooting. You have this incident where he was allegedly kind of trying to court this woman, met her on social media, and he tracked her to this bar where she was on a date with another man. And he pressured her, and then allegedly he flashed a gun to her, at a bar during normal service hours. And then after the shooting, he and another woman allegedly attacked a female Chicago police officer at this bar district in Wicker Park that led to this, you know, him being relieved of his police powers. So those are things that the Rivera family is certainly seizing on to say they believe that there's a pattern here with this man that involves domestic violence and violence against women.
Certainly, and a lot more digging to do, which you'll be doing, the digging.
Absolutely.
And we're going to steer the conversation over to public transit for a second here. David, the latest threat the president is throwing Chicago's way has to do now with the CTA. What's going on?
Well, the latest is that in this deplorable case where a woman on the Blue Line was doused with gasoline and lit on fire, the Trump administration now is saying that it will withhold from money from the CTA until we kind of get a safety plan in effect that can prevent violence on public transit in Illinois. There's a backstory here, though. This is not the first threat against public transit funding that President Trump has done. What happened is that President Biden, before he left office, locked in billions of dollars in commitments to the CTA Red Line extension, which Trump has criticized as being kind of a woke agenda, expanding the public transit to the far south sides because apparently people down there don't deserve public transportation. And so this just kind of fits into this pattern of just picking on Illinois and Chicago. He likes to pick on J.B. Pritzker and Brandon Johnson, the mayor, but also really focusing on our transit because he knows how important it is to this city. Chicago does have a problem with safety on its public transit. In this huge $1.5 billion transit bill that was put together that's trying to restructure the transit agencies in northeastern Illinois, there is money set aside and probably not enough money to really address the problem of crime, especially on the CTA. There's now a move afoot to be putting police, uniformed police officers on trains, which has not been the case lately. There is a need here, but withholding, say, CTA red line extension money is probably not the solution.
And there was a deadline on this.
Today, preliminary plan to reduce violence.
I'm sure it's fixed by now.
Yes. And I'm certain there have been plans in the past. I'm wondering, are they just going to recycle a safety plan that they had before and say, yeah, hey, we're on it? Because there have been many meetings and questions and even that no smoking plan, both by Conway and the mayor this year. As someone who takes public transportation all the time, I know there are problems. But is withholding our funding going to help that? Not clear.
And to Monica's point, too, it's not as if this has gone unnoticed.
Right.
Maybe the fixes that are being proposed are not adequate, but this is very much noticed. It became a big issue during this transit restructuring talks. I think surprised some of the people who were really just focused on, like, the funding cliff that everybody was talking about. And as they held public hearings and held meetings, the idea that people are afraid to ride the CTA emerged as a major issue, but trying to get it fixed by today is a little difficult.
Yes.
And especially some of the most, busy lines, right? Red line, blue line,
green.
As the mayor said, there's a real issue with unhoused people relying on transit for housing. But this is a stubborn problem, right? We've kind of beaten back the crime rate. It's fallen significantly, but on the CTA, it's up 10%. And this has kind of been a continuing concern and issue that really started in the pandemic. And the city has tried different things and spent a lot of money, right, trying to address crime and safety on the CTA, including this huge contract that was signed at one point for these yellow vest wearing people who it kind of became a joke, right? You would see it on social media, group of them standing around looking at their cell phones and stuff. And it's like, well, what's going on here? The CPT does have dedicated transit units. So is there a need for Larry Snelling and the mayor to look at this and look at the resources and where they should be dedicated? I take the Brown Line. The Brown Line's great. It's kind of like a commuter rail, right? But if you go on the Red Line and the Blue Line, especially going through downtown, it can be pretty dodgy, and that could be a deterrent from people using, a city service. So,
and we've seen in New York City, for example, which has a big police presence on its public transit, and it's had a big impact on making that system safer, and so there are fixes available. I think there's $30 million available to be putting uniformed officers on the CTA, and I think we can expect to see something fairly soon. Whether President Trump's pressure is a factor in that or not.
I do something called the Red Line Report, where I rate my last four rides for cleanliness, safety, smoking, on time. And the timing has been great. Sometimes they're even early. But smoking went up for a while during the summer. It went down. Now it's back up again. I look for people who are in need of social services. And the Red Line has been improving, but I've seen more problems. I also rated the Blue Line when I stupidly tried to take a picture of this group of teenagers smoking in my car.
How dare you?
And they caught me. They said, "Are you taking a picture of me?" I said, "No, I'm not." And I ran out of the train as fast as I could.
Well, there is certainly a lack of consistency from line to line and from train to train. I mean, first car versus eighth car, it's kind of like being on a different planet sometimes.
Yeah.
So, David, you're going to have to leave us shortly, and we'll get into why in just a minute. But before we get to that, I did want to get your thoughts and all of your thoughts on Mike Madigan being back in the headlines this week. Fill us in, if you will, about what's happening this week with Mike Madigan.
Well, we've seen President Trump give pardons to drug dealers, fraudsters, et cetera.
Former governors.
Corrupt Illinois governors by the name of Rod Blagojevich. And I guess Madigan's just trying to get in on the action. He was a guy who always knew how to be in the middle of the action. He is requesting a pardon. There is a clemency process underway. And he's been sentenced to 7.5 years. He began serving his term in October, so he's been in a couple months now. We saw a case study is Ed Burke, who had a 2-year sentence and got out after only 10 months of service. The fact that both of these people are as old as they are is a factor in their favor. It's easier to get pardoned if you're really old. And if Madigan were to serve his full term, he would be in jail through March of 2032. He would be more than 90 years old upon release. And so part of the argument here is he's old, he's not a danger to society, et cetera, et cetera. But this is the sort of just back channel stuff that in the era of Trump, if you make the right appeal, I don't know what his right appeal in this case would be. It's not exactly like there was a woke prosecutor going after him. This was one of the epic cases of political corruption in the history of the state of Illinois and really the country, with all kinds of evidence against him. But you just never know these days what might appeal to the president, and we'll wait and see.
Do we think it's possible he's going to get this pardon, Monica, Tom?
If he promises to become a Republican in Illinois, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a pretty simple appeal that I was a powerful person and people were out to get me, and this was a weaponization of the DOJ. And Trump seems to think that there's activist judges within the Northern District of Illinois. He said that quite a lot in the last couple months. So who knows? I'm hoping that we get some more clarity on what exactly Madigan is seeking here. There was an interesting paragraph in the Tribune story about this, that they reached out to a bunch of his lawyers and none of them had prepared this this proposal. So is that an indication that Madigan is doing some jailhouse lawyering down in Morgantown, West Virginia?
He's still working the phones.
Yeah.
So, David, you're headed over to a funeral, we should say, before you leave us, for a beloved colleague that many of us in Chicago journalism have worked with. Monica, I know you were at the Tribune. I was an intern at the Tribune in 2009. Tell us a little bit about Bruce Dold.
Well, Bruce Dold, I started reporting when Harold Washington was running for mayor, and Bruce was already established as one of the great political reporters in the really history, modern history of Chicago journalism. He was just an intrepid journalist and had a certain stature and elegance about him that I think appealed to people. He, over time, became a longtime editorial page editor of the Tribune. I actually worked under him for a brief period there and just saw his wisdom, his ability to get the best work out of people, his invitation for everybody to argue a point and then finally focus us all on what the position ought to be. Just one personal bit is that when I went to the Better Government Association 8 years ago, the Tribune at that time was at near the height of its powers and wouldn't work in partnership with other organizations. Bruce decided he wanted to do this and worked out a thing with me. There was a lot of internal resistance to it. Bruce overcame that. And the first story that we, the BJ, and the Tribune did together won a Pulitzer Prize. And the last Pulitzer that the Tribune has done. I think it's fair to say Bruce is probably, with all due respect to current leadership, probably the last great editor of the Chicago Tribune, of the Chicago Tribune that we knew and loved growing up, that still had international bureaus, still had a Washington bureau, really was the great paper that it was. As hard as they're working there these days, they just don't have the resources to do the sorts of things Bruce was able to lead and I think got the most out of his staff.
For sure. It's a real loss to the journalism community and so young, you know, 70 is not that old.
An editor-in-chief, a publisher, and a Pulitzer Prize winner. Thank you for sharing that, David, and thank you for joining us today.
Sorry to have to leave you, but I'm glad to be able to be at Bruce's funeral.
Certainly.
Thank you.
So we've been reporting on immigration enforcement kind of winding down, but last Saturday there were some ICE agents out in force in West Suburban Elgin. Tom, do you remember what happened in Elgin with these ICE agents?
Yes. Kind of out of the same playbook we've been seeing for the last few months here, but a man was in a vehicle chase and he ran into an apartment building, he got onto a balcony of an apartment building, and he kind of stayed there. And community members rallied around him. They ordered pizzas. People were trying to help him however they could as this kind of
large group of ICE agents were around. And there was, you know, what we've seen in the past, right? Kind of a clash between the agents and the community members, which included elected officials, State Senator Castro. And ultimately, though, this devolved into the use of chemical munitions yet again. So we saw gas deployed, we saw flashbang grenades, and ultimately ICE breached the home and they took this man into custody. And the Department of Homeland Security later reported this man was a member of Tren de Aragua, the same Venezuelan prison gang that they've invoked repeatedly during this, you know, deportation crackdown that's underway now. Lo and behold, the next day, the Tribune was able to speak to an aunt of this man who said he was a hardworking man and he was in no way violent and he was not a member of this gang. So kind of beat by beat what we've seen time and time again now. But this was a bit jarring because I think, as most people in the Chicago area were, there was some relief when the Border Patrol and Greg Bovino left. And we, you know, hadn't seen kind of these huge blow-ups so much. There have been reported arrests since the Border Patrol left. But there hadn't been this type of spectacle. And so, you know, on the ground there, what our reporter, Mohammed Samer, reported was that people felt like this was just like another attack on the community intended to invoke fear. And, you know, now we're still bracing for the possibility that another surge of federal agents comes back to, again, target the Chicago area.
One another example of false claims, right? You've been seeing a lot of Department of Homeland Security claims being proven false. Monica, you took a deep dive into this. What's going on?
Well, you know, because a lot of these things are said, and oh, Tren de Aragua, that's the headline people see, and then they forget when the refutation, when the evidence against it shows up. I thought I would just collect the work that I've done that wonderful colleagues at BEZ, Sun Times, ProPublica, and Tribune have done, and put 12 different statements that DHS has said that turned out to be untrue or overturned by courts together. And I hadn't realized how powerful that would be, but putting it together, it develops a pattern. You know, first of all, they said that they're continuing to characterize it as arresting the worst of the worst criminal illegal aliens, end quote. But a recent analysis of just the people that they took during Operation Midway Blitz in Illinois, only 3% had violent criminal histories. On a national level, only 26% have any criminal convictions. So that's not all worst of the worst. And as you see, CPB was picking up people who were installing windows, people who were mowing lawns, people who were on their way to work in a construction zone. It was not targeted. And I will say, though this was an ICE often targets people, has cases on people. CPB, when they came in with Bovino, they were picking up a lot of collateral people they just happened to see. DHS and Border Patrol commander officials and Border Patrol commander Greg Bovino claimed that he threw tear gas in Little Village after he was hit on the head with a rock. They said this several times. When he had his deposition and he was under oath, he said, oh, well, yeah, maybe I didn't. I said, no, actually, I was almost hit on the head, and that's why I threw it. Then on the third day of his deposition, when showed in video, oh, okay, you're right, it never happened. I'm looking into whether or not that constitutes perjury, frankly. And you have Trisha McLaughlin, the Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs. You know, she famously claimed on X, on a post that is still there, that this teenager who was tackled on her lawn in Hoffman Estates by a DHS agent was actually a burglar being tackled by a CPD officer. CPD said, we weren't anywhere near that area. There's a Hoffman Estates squad car in the background, and yet they still claim, no, this is CPD tackling a burglar, not a kid, a teenager in Hoffman Estates. And as these false claims build upon each other, it makes you wonder, you know, when in Elgin, they say this was a Tren de Aragua gang member, should we believe it? Should we be printing it? Should we say they claim and they have many false claims in their background? I think it really erodes the trust in institutions, and I hate to see that, but in the heat of Operation Midway Blitz, we didn't have time to fact-check everything, and so I wanted to take some time now that we've got a little bit of a lull and say, okay, let's take a look at 12 of these.
And I think,
you know, the one that is still sticking with me now that I think really deserves an explanation is the shooting of Maramar Martinez.
Right.
She was charged in this case. Well, first of all,
she was shot
five times, and the Border Patrol agent who shot her
bragged about it
to his friends in a group chat, bragging about his accuracy as a gunman. And ultimately, though, he was able to drive the car that she allegedly rammed into to Maine, where it was partially buffed out, the damage, and the case was dropped. But now what we're hearing is that a different U.S. attorney's office is likely looking into this case now after the charges were dropped. That was said at the last hearing. So perhaps we will get some explanation and some correction of the record in that case.
Another really biggie was Christy Noem in Indiana saying, we have not arrested or detained any American citizens. Mike Puente here did a great job of refuting that on the spot. And ProPublica said actually 170 U.S. citizens have been arrested or detained in this operation.
But as we've been saying, too, even if you're there in the flesh and you ask them a question, is this true?
Deny.
Right. So, Tom, I do want to get into one thing regarding Department of Homeland Security. Some charges, some pretty disturbing charges, have been filed against a Customs and Border Protection agent. What are the details of that?
They are disturbing. The agent's name is Luis Uribe. He worked mostly at O'Hare. He's a Customs and Border Protection agent, and he's essentially accused of using his badge and gun to force his way into hotel rooms and to sexually assault women who worked in the sex trade. And this happened between February to October of 2022. And there were this series of assaults. He, in one case, at least took money from a woman who tried to, like, plead with him and say, let me just pay you. And at some point, this became such an issue that he made an agreement and met with someone and agreed to stop the assaults in exchange for free sex. But despite that agreement, he continued to do this. So Uribe, it's unclear whether he was involved in the Midway Blitz operation that just rocked the Chicago area, but this was just he was just indicted or just charged this week and had his first court appearance. He'll have a detention hearing, and I'm assuming we're going to get more information about this. I believe that they're looking into whether there was more assaults that he could be charged in here, but really terrible allegations.
So something to put on your list of things to continue digging into.
As if there aren't enough.
Yeah.
We're going to turn our attention now over to Indiana, where just yesterday the Senate voted down an effort to redraw their congressional map. The president had been urging them to do as the legislatures in Texas, Missouri, also North Carolina did. So, Monica, what does this decision say about Indiana and about the president's power right now?
Well, it's very mixed. You know, Indiana, the majority of the House and Senate are Republicans, and the House did pass it. But the Senate decided in the vote 31-19 to reject this redistricting. And now the governor of Indiana, who's a big Trump ally, is vowing to challenge the reelection campaigns of them. But many of the senators said they, quote, love Trump. They're big Trump supporters, but their constituents were just not all about a mid-decade redistricting.
And as you said, you know, there was a bit of a full court press from the White House here, yeah. Right? Vance went there. But after kind of taking the L, Trump said, oh, no, I wasn't really that invested in this whole thing. And but the Hoosiers clearly wanted to exert their independence here, even if they largely support Trump. Question remains whether the MAGA coalition is being depleted based on, you know, a slew of issues, right? The Epstein issue, the release of the files, the
issues with the economy and affordability right now. And obviously we are seeing support wane among his dedicated base. And as this is kind of inching toward the midterms that he was really trying to influence here with this move.
And I should say that some of those senators voted against the redistricting even after getting swatted, even having, you know, basically people sending danger their way. And I think some of them said, you know what, you're going to try to threaten me. I'm going to vote the way I want to vote.
And applause from J.B. Pritzker for this.
Yes. And Speaker Chris Welch, you know, and I'm not sure that's going to help their campaigns to have J.B. Pritzker on their side. But it will mean that probably, not clear, but probably Illinois will not launch its own redistricting because of this.
And now taking the conversation a little bit closer to home here over to Michigan Avenue, where people were protesting outside of the Starbucks Roastery. This is on Wednesday, calling it the Red Cup Rebellion. Monica, what was that all about?
It was a day of solidarity with them. I saw some of them out there, and they are protesting what they believe are unfair labor practices at the giant nationwide cafe, and we might see more of it.
And let's shift to snow, because sure. I love talking about the weather. We've had a very snowy start to this winter. We've got the first sub-zero weekend of the year. Temperatures potentially going to be in, what, the 15s over the weekend. Bears, you going?
I'm not going, but I'll be watching. I hope for a bounce back here. And yeah, I'll be inside in front of the fire. Hopefully I don't have to go shovel too much.
Not standing at Soldier Field.
God, no.
And Monica, you actually have some guidance for people who were looking for indoor things to do if it's going to get cold. You wrote about some independently owned shops that people might consider visiting, patronizing for holiday gifts.
Yeah, we have so many great independent bookstores and gift stores throughout the city. And we asked our readers at Axios to tell us, and they include the MCA store, Penelope's, Gemini,
Posh. I love Penelope's.
Yeah, and do you ever go to Posh on State
yes.
Street? Oh my gosh, like European flea market stuff. Hazel on Montrose. The list goes on. Some of my favorites, I really love the fair trade stuff because you know that they vetted that for labor stuff. So check out Axios for great gift shops.
And from gifting to eating, potentially?
Yes.
Restaurant Week?
There's a campaign. Well, Restaurant Week, all the reservations opened up this week, so get your reservations now because the really good ones go fast. But also there's a campaign by Chicago Chef's Cook called Eat Here, Eat Near, Eat Here. If you eat at six restaurants and post about it and tag them on there and then show them about these six restaurants before January 22nd, you will probably get like a $20 gift certificate. Certificate for someone. You might get a tasting with Rick Bayless of Mezcal and Chocolate. And they really, you know, during these doldrum months, they really want people to go and raise the morale of our local restaurants. Can't be a chain, can't be a national chain. It has to be a local independent restaurant.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Andrea Guthman, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/InTheLoop. Thanks for listening.